Hey, it's Jim Hoffman from EMS Office Hours.
And it's Josh Knapp joining you tonight, Jim.
What's that?
I'm joining you tonight on your EMS Office Hours.
Every Sunday. Every Sunday, I guess.
Well,
today is April 1st.
You take me for granted, you know, listen, you can just call a taxi as well.
Yeah, don't get me started. One thing at a time. Well,
we're your
April 1st.
April Fools.
Yeah. Well, actually, today is the official launch of my EMS Web Summit website at emswebsummit.com.
Yeah, you've been talking about this for a little while.
Yeah, well, today's the actual. I've been kind of putting it out there a little bit, getting some people registering here and there, but now the launch of the site is official, and people can go and register. It's free to register, and it's an all-day webinar event with I'm going to have 12 different EMS speakers, and there's actually 13 topics. So one speaker is going to do two separate topics that day. And pretty much talking everything from social media using in EMS all the way up to abdominal trauma and geriatrics. So it promises to be a pretty good day. So I'm excited about that. And Josh, I know that you've taken wantonew.com and you've ponied up some sponsorship in the form of some giveaways for the event during the live event.
Wait, what? What?
Yeah,
I did.
Well, you did now because
I don't remember
you having the website, so you kind of stuck with it now.
Oh crap!
Yeah, yeah.
Boy, that's a way to put me out front, man. Thanks a lot.
Right. Well, that's something to do with
everyone. I understand. You got to mention that.
I wish you could have got Zoll on here because I would have just put them on the spot and said, "Hey, I thought I heard you're putting up a life pack for the giveaway."
Yeah. Yeah, Zoll is putting up a life pack, by the way. You heard it here first. So, you know, just register for the summit, and at the end of the summit, Zoll will be picking one contestant and sending them a life pack.
Yeah,
it may be a life
someday.
Pack 10, but, you know, it's a life pack. So,
well,
you know,
actually, I've got you giving away some stuff. I've got Talon Rescue giving away a few things, and also I have Stat Gear Tools giving away some stuff too. So people that register for the event throughout the day, I will be randomly selecting people to get some of these giveaways that we're going to be giving out. So the registration is free, like I said, and people can go over to the website and register and attend one or all 13 of the sessions, whatever they want to do. They can go and come or however they want to do it. There's no locked in event. They can go to just one session. They can come in the beginning, come towards the middle, leave, whatever they want to do. So it's flexible for them. And actually, the EMS Blogs Network itself is also sponsoring the event also. So that's pretty cool. We get them to sponsor this as well. So excited
now,
about that.
You and I were talking about, and I know it's not official, and you can't give a CMEs for this, even though it's an educational summit, and, you know, you're going to learn a lot. You know, I'm looking forward to it because, you know, there's a lot to be learned. There's a lot to be refreshed. There's a lot of good ideas going out there. So even though officially, quote-unquote, we can't get CMEs from any, like, certifying source, you've said there's a way in the past people have been able to print out their attendance and bring it to their own medical center.
Normally what I've done in the past, and I've held webinars in the past with EMS speakers and educators, and normally what I do is allow the attendees to download the handout or the outline of the session, and then they can take that to their medical director or ALS coordinator and apply for local or regional CME, you know, for their agency and whatnot. And from what I've got, feedback that I've gotten from people is that most of their medical directors or ALS coordinators do accept it, and at the minimum, they'll give them at least half of the hours, depending upon the topic and who's teaching it and whatever. Actually, I've been in little discussions since this is kind of taking off a little bit with some other entities out there who are interested in already getting on board for next year's, where they want to go ahead and make it accredited CME for next year's event. So it's a little ways off, but I'm already working on it. So
next year we're going to be actually by attending, we're actually going to be able to get some no turn away, real honest to goodness CME. But this year for attending, you're going to get the notes, and you're going to be able to go to your medical director and your coordinate and your coordinating training folks and say, listen, I attended this. You know, it was so many hours, and you know, can you give me a few hours to go towards my research, if that's the case, if you do see a base refresher, and they're usually pretty good about that. So it's a win-win. Yeah.
I mean, listen, I've got a lot of speakers coming on. I got Bob Page and Peter Canning and Dan Limmer and Rami Duckworth and stuff like that that are coming on that are well-known, experienced EMH educators and presenters. So, and their topics have been accepted for many other EMS conferences and things like that. So it's not like they're raw stuff. What's that?
Yeah. I've caught most of them at EMS today. They've been there. Bob Page had a breakout, for crying out loud. He had to pay extra to get into his doodad. So this sounds like outstanding, man. This is good.
Right,
work.
Exactly. So, you know, I don't see a problem for most of what we're going to be doing there. So it should be pretty good. Actually, Tim Noonan, Rogue Medic, he's not on tonight that I can see yet, but he's agreed to do a session too. He's going to actually talk a little bit about the epinephrine and cardiac arrest management and all that, so that should be pretty cool, getting him to come on and give his uninterrupted opinion on and feedback and
what
he's
researched
and all that.
Yeah, I will not be there to interrupt
that,
him
so. Right, exactly.
Or frustrate him or make him crazy, as I usually am. So, you know, that will be worth the credit alone.
Exactly. Well, listen, Josh, tonight, of course, I want to thank anyone for listening live, or if you're listening to recording either through iTunes or on the website at emsofficehours.com. I appreciate you for taking time listening in to what we're talking about. And tonight, the topic pretty much is this is something that you mentioned last week, Josh, when you talked about, we talked a little bit about how Suffolk County, I believe it is, Suffolk County, New York, is looking to give their EMTs a way to give Narcan intranasally. And from reading that memo, it's going to be part of Albany, New York, as well, some other areas in New York where they're trying to give this as an added means for EMTs to give drugs to patients.
Right.
That got me to thinking a little bit about not just how EMTs have been able to give that medication, or looking to give that medication. Also, things like when they're allowed to give nitroglycerin, or they're allowed to give albuterol treatments, or the EpiPen. There are some places out there that let their EMTs intubate with a combi tube.
Well, they did that on Long Island. They experimented with that on Long Island, with and I got to say, with great success.
Yeah.
You know, but they never went forward with it. So, and I'd love to know why. I'd love to know, you know, if there was a reasoning
the
why.
The thing is, I just start to wonder, like, you know, how much of this is you know, we've talked about this a little bit in the past, too. And I mentioned a little bit at one point as far as what we should be called as an EMT or a paramedic and whatnot. And it seems like they just keep wanting to add more and more onto the EMT plate. And yet they still want to keep differentiating both levels, but the training keeps increasing. But, you know, EMT pay is not increasing when they're being given this additional responsibility. You know, agencies have to go and retrain their EMTs every year for annual in-servicing on given these medications. And then there's also the question of how much training goes into it to begin with, you know, to give these medications and to understand the thought process behind the medication itself, the pharmacology behind it, the patient assessment. You know, you're talking about an EMT who's gone through however many months of training versus the paramedic who's gone through a year, year and a half, 2 years of training.
Sometimes
you
4 years of training.
Right, and now you've got EMTs who you're giving this responsibility to make these decisions and to give this medication to patients.
Well, I think that it's an argument of task appropriateness, and that's where I think that the differentiation really needs, the distinctions really have to be made between a medic and an EMT. Like, you know, listen, EMTs are, we're not talking about a class of people. I mean, they're the same, you know, individuals as you and I, and you and I were EMTs when we first started, and then we just chose to go for the extra education, the extra responsibility. Because keep in mind, wow, you know, one of the first gripes after, you know, the shininess of the white patch wears off is, and in New York, for folks listening, the medic patch in New York is a white patch. It's a yellow patch for EMTs in New York. So if I reference that, you'll know. But you know, you can recall the conversations of, holy crap, you know what? If we now, there's more reasons that they can come down on us and stop us from working, or we can lose our job if we do something incorrectly. There's more reasons, there's more responsibilities, and there's more headaches associated with this. You know, you document something wrong and you can get your tail slammed.
Yeah.
So it's not all fun and games. You know, it's not like you stand up and say, I've got a Superman logo on my shirt and I can do anything. That's not the way.
Yeah.
You know, for reality, I mean, you know, I know there's a lot of bullshit out there with paragods and you know, people, you know, talking about paramedics doing, you know, the impossible or whatever. And you know, you get down to the discussion of EMTs when they sort of are going through a saving face routine. They're saying, well, we save paramedics. And I'm like, you know, come on. Well, you know, it doesn't even faze me, because the truth of the matter is I was an EMT before as a paramedic. And, you know, if you turn around and say, hey, you know, don't forget your roots, that's a better way of approaching it. I don't like this conflict. The only time that I get annoyed is when you have somebody, an EMT, saying, or you know, based on a level of training, and making an ignorant statement, and I hate that. So, but keep in mind, it's not a class of people; it's a class of training, and we have to make that distinction, because a lot of people take this stuff personally.
Yeah, Josh, I think I've got. I think Bob Sullivan might be with us.
Awesome.
Let's see if he's Bob, is that you?
Yes. Hey guys.
Hey Bob.
Hey Bob.
Sorry,
how you doing?
Sorry,
great.
Keep on hold.
Oh no, that's okay.
I know.
You always get amused by listening to my diatribe, anyway, huh?
Yeah, I was enjoying it. I just wanted to say, it's so exciting to be an EMS now with things like, you know, your web summit, and so many experts in EMS can access so many people at such a low cost. They used to be able to, you know, see only once or twice a year at a conference and have to travel for. So it's just a really exciting way to share ideas and get educated.
Yeah, well, it's the type of thing with that too. Like, you know, I think the availability of education out there for EMS providers is also growing, where it doesn't have to always be a butt in the seat type conference type thing. There's a lot of webcasts going on and virtual type training happening at pretty much a lot of different venues. I know GEMS has their own, and EMS One does some every other month, something like that too. So they're out there. You just got to kind of look for them, keep your eyes open, you know.
Yes.
So it's pretty cool, stuff. But Bob, what are you thinking on? I mean, we're talking. I mean, the thing that motivated tonight's podcast really was the whole the thing about giving Narcan intranasally for EMTs to start doing that, because there was a certain area there where they felt they have a high incidence of heroin overdose, and they wanted to give the EMTs the the ability to do something because the paramedics weren't always available to get there, or they were too far out and things like that. So they're trying to give the EMTs now the ability to give it to reverse the heroin effects.
Well, I wish Tim was here tonight because I know he has a lot of.
Yeah.
I don't know which medication he likes more, epinephrine or Narcan. But you know, the question is, why are they doing this? If you said they can't get ALS to these heroin overdoses fast enough, why not? And is this like a Band-Aid? You know, in EMS, it seems like we put a lot of, you know, we stick our fingers in a lot of dams to sort of cover up systemic problems. And is this what they're doing? And how well are they managing? I like Narcan more than Tim does, but, you know, you see on the ad on EMS blogs.
Tim prefers the BVM.
You don't need Narcan. You need a BVM. And
right.
If EMTs are managing the airway with a BVM well enough, then
right.
The time that those patients get Narcan really shouldn't matter that much. And if they're not managing
right.
it well, Narcan's not going to fix that.
Yeah, well, you know, there's another tack on that view. And it's, you know, a BVM has its inherent disadvantages, and I have yet to ever see a patient well managed on a BVM over a long period of time. So, and what I mean by that, you know, with gastric distension and everything else, and then, aspiration that can come from, you know, gastric distension. I always found that long term, and you know, you really, this is stuff that's documented as well. The longer you bag somebody, the more you run the risk of some air with every breath getting into the stomach and eventually ejecting the stomach contents. So, you know, if there's nobody around and they strongly suspect an overdose, you're absolutely, you know, it becomes a tool that can be used to hopefully get them breathing on their own with some time. But you're absolutely right with the aspect that if it is one of the myriad of reasons other than an overdose, you're not going to get anything. And specifically an opiate overdose, you're not going to get anything. So, you know, there's a sort of a little virtuous circle that happens. Do you have good BVM technique? You know, are you...
But, Josh, doesn't it come down to that, though, in the end?
What?
It comes down to proper training on how to use a BVM and how to properly bag somebody and give them the right volume every time you squeeze the bag and maintaining that airway at a BLS fashion. If an EMT can't BVM, the answer shouldn't be let's give them Narcan.
Well, that's what I'm saying is that that little slice of where Narcan works may advantage those patients because there is so uneven level and it's so difficult to manage over the long term. Bag valve mask ventilations. And that's why, you know, you talk about, there's like two ways to look at this. You know, combi tubes are great. And so what you could have is, if you have somebody who is unconscious, not breathing on their own, then have them start a combi tube. And, you know, give them a couple of breaths of BVM. If that's not working, then step up the airway management to a more secure level of airway management and don't mix in the Narcan. Don't try to wake the patient. Leave that for the ED. You have to approach it from one direction or the other, because if you sort of approach it from both directions, I think you put the patients more at risk. And one of the problems that I don't like about putting this tool of this drug in the hands of people who aren't really trained for all of the for all of the side effects, and I mean side effects of, you know, a person waking up, going into withdrawal and vomiting all over the place, then compromising their airway because of that. You know, from that to seizures to all the things that can happen when you give Narcan, they're not capable of handling that. So, you know, why are we putting this tool in their hands? It seems like a good idea, but, you know, I don't think it's a well-thought-out one.
Well, I go back to, I think that there is a package that whoever is going to be taking the patient to the hospital should have available. And Narcan be one of those things. Everyone should have a defibrillator available. I think everyone should have a 12-lead EKG available. And I think they should have pain management available. I think they should have a medication to stop seizures available. And Narcan's one of them. And if a service in a community can't deliver that reliably to the patients that need it, then that's a system problem. And if your answer is to train BLS providers with give them an extra tool, then eventually I
think it's an incomplete tool.
No, I agree.
I mean, what you just said is, listen, I think that everybody should be able to manage cardiac, manage overdoses, and manage seizures, and manage pain. And you know what? We've been managing pain in the field since World War I, with, you know, doses of morphine in little stylets that were, you know, injectable, and an untrained soldier could do that. And, you know, in the same rule of, well, if they pass out, then you can give them, then you can BVM them, then, you know, why aren't we giving EMTs morphine to take in the field? To take in the field. Oops.
But, you know, I don't know. I think that the issue here, too, that I'm having with this is I've seen this before when they've started out and they want to give EMTs albuterol, and they did that. And then they gave EMTs the ability to assist the patient with nitroglycerin. You know, and each time that they've come out with these programs, they give the EMTs a program, they write a protocol for it, they give them the minimal training to get them, to understand, you know, what the, and they don't give the training as far as what the drug is doing. They give the training as far as what the patient should look like and what they have to do. And every time that I've had an EMT on the scene with an asthmatic or with a chest pain, and they're able to do those interventions, they don't do it. They sit and they wait for the medic to get there. They're able to do it, but they won't because they're afraid of taking on that responsibility.
Or worse,
and I think
yet,
you're going to get a
situation, and they do
right
thing to make it.
And I think, and I think you're going to get EMTs who are going to get on an overdose call with a patient who's apneic and they're barely breathing, and they're going to say, "Okay, hold the horses here. You know, I'm not going to start treating this unconscious, unresponsive, barely breathing the patient. You know, I'm going to wait for the medics to get here." You know, they're going to be screaming on the radio for the medics. What's the ETA and the medics? Where are the medics? You know, and meanwhile, they're going to have the tool in their bag, and they're going to hesitate to use it. They're not going to want to use it. And I think the reason why they're going to do that is because I think part of it is because the EMTs become more and more medic-dependent. And I think also because they're going to be hesitant because they're not going to have or feel that they don't have enough training to make that decision to give that medication.
You know, the example I thought of, we were talking about this last week, actually, before I saw what the topic was going to be, about giving EMTs in our area EpiPens. And one of my coworkers said, I don't trust EMTs to have EpiPens. I don't know if they know when it would be appropriate to use. And I agree, but I think that these kinds of conversations are the same ones that medical directors have when they're talking about giving paramedics new skills. Like,
well,
RSI.
But there's also a risk reward to that. I mean, do you know why EMTs have EpiPens?
No,
I mean,
I don't.
Do you know how it all started? Because originally EMTs were not, when EpiPens came out, EMTs weren't given EpiPens. They weren't allowed to use it. It was a, epinephrine Tom can, I'm sorry. Tim.
But the patients that got prescribed them and then they needed some help using them?
No. What happened was they had a couple of deaths at camps. At sleepaway camps and stuff, where kids were stung by a bee or had allergic reaction, and they didn't have, the camp nurse didn't have the ability to give epi or wasn't around, and the EpiPen was locked up. And they said, this is absolutely ridiculous. This is, in the dosages we're talking about, it's a life-saving and it's a rather benign drug when it comes to a very narrow class of patients. And so what happened was they said, camp counselors, as a part of their, emergency pack, should have EpiPens for their kids. And so for a couple of years, camp counselors were the people who could give Epi. And then, the EMT said, well, why can't we do it if camp counselors can do it? I mean, the same should apply for us. And that's how it transferred to EMTs. So it's something that we weren't trusted with it, but camp counselors were.
Well, that applies to a lot of things. And with RSI, there's a huge risk, and the reward is debatable. But
right.
Do EMTs, are they able to recognize? The thing is, when they roll something like this out, the people that roll it out have a certain patient in mind that they want to be able to help. Kids at
right.
the camp who suddenly get short of breath, who don't have asthma and break out into hives or having an allergic reaction. But I show up on scenes now that aren't so clear, and I'm scratching my head about, is this an allergic reaction or is this something else? And am I going to make a patient worse by giving them Epi? And those are the situations that I'm having trouble with. An EMT that goes on, a tenth of the number of calls that I go to, if it's not their full-time job, is going to have a lot less experience and be able to make this determination. And there are a few patients where all of these treatments can make them worse.
The one thing I
do think that EMS or BLS should be doing is CPAP, because they're trained to give people oxygen, they're trained to use a bag valve mask when someone goes into respiratory failure. And CPAP's just something that needs to be applied somewhere in between there. So I don't think there's any reason why CPAP is, considered an ALS skill, and now that they have ones that can just go onto a regular oxygen regulator, I think that's definitely something
it's
that should.
Well, parameter, it's the same thing for Epi that is for CPAP. There's some parameters that need to be strictly followed before it is administered. And I think that when you're talking about the EpiPen, and you're standing there and you're saying, is this an allergic reaction or is this anaphylaxis, the distinction for severe anaphylaxis, which is really when the EpiPen is required, are pretty clear, and they're an emergent situation, so they need rapid treatment. So giving those, but when you have somebody whose judgment or training is not up to par, then you're running the big risk that they're going to make the situation worse.
Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I was going to say that, a lot of these drugs too, if you think about it, the albuterol, the epi, the nitroglycerin, aspirin administration, these are things that we're telling patients to do without anybody even being there a lot of the time. It's just a dispatcher will say, well, do you take nitroglycerin? Okay, well, go ahead and take one before the ambulance gets there without taking your blood pressure or anything like that. And the same thing with the EpiPen. If you have an EpiPen, if you get people who get stung by a bee, but because they might be allergic or they have a past experience of being allergic, they're going to immediately go ahead and inject themselves with the EpiPen, whether or not they're having a true anaphylactic reaction or not. And the same thing with albuterol. You get asthmatics who will go ahead and take the albuterol treatment when they might not even be having an asthma attack. So I guess the thought process is, if the patients are doing it without having any professionals there to assess them before they do it, why not let the EMTs go ahead and have some training and then carry these drugs and be able to do it? In the case of Narcan, I know that they had places that were able to buy the Narcan, like, you know, some of these, I guess, these kind of group homes where they have residents who are known drug abusers and things like that, where they were letting them buy Narcan and then give it the same way, intranasally, to these people, so they wouldn't have to call an ambulance and take them to the hospital and all this stuff and help them resume their breathing if they became unresponsive. But at the same time, that's also been starting to be taken away because of some of the side effects that we mentioned already with that drug. They've stopped letting those places carry the Narcan because they're realizing that there's more of the danger is there. That could be an issue if it's given at the wrong time. And I think the same thing goes with all the other drugs as well. I mean, how many you get the patients who are asthmatic and maybe it's not, you know, the whole thing of all that weed is not asthma. You know, but the patient doesn't know that. They feel they're wheezing, they feel they can't breathe, they take that butyl treatment, and then they wind up flashing over and end up being in severe CHF.
Well, patients generally know a lot more about what's wrong with it, and they know a lot more about how their medication
how
a nebulizer works than even experienced paramedics.
But you have the instances, though, where they might not read it right, though. That's the thing.
Right, but my problem with most DM education at every level is how you learn how to, in a two-hour lab scenario, how to give someone intranasal Narcan. You know, then you're dropped into combat, basically, when you're facing with a patient who's not breathing, or you're facing with a child who's anaphylactic. And the EMT curriculum, even the new one with more hours, only requires keen patient assessments in some setting, like a clinic. It doesn't require any ride-along time. It doesn't require any internship. And so you're going to already, you know, give someone a tool that taking into the worst situation that you could, some of the worst situations you could be in, and expect them to perform it and ration and think through all of the, you know, indications and go through the protocol with, you know, do you need to call first, that sort of thing. I just don't know if that's realistic.
Well, Bob, the logical extension of that scenario that you just gave is that, you know, one of the things that comes up with being a paramedic is, and I referenced this at the very beginning of the show, is the responsibility that rides with that certification. Because you are responsible for making a correct diagnosis and treating it. If you make an incorrect diagnosis, you better damn well have your facts straight and the reason that you made that incorrect diagnosis, and somebody else within a reasonable setting should say that, yeah, I could see how you could come to that conclusion, and I understand now why your treatment was wrong in order for you to stay viable, otherwise you're SOL. Now, where is the responsibility to the EMT? You know, what's the backslide if they do something wrong and then, you know, and then I got 2 hours of training. Are they off the hook immediately? Who's responsible for that? And I think there's an aspect.
Sure, and there's a whole thing. Do it takes, you know, should people be punished after they make a mistake. And all the healthcare literature, all of the, you know, systems thinking and the flight safety checklist things have recognized that punishing people after they make a mistake generally isn't effective. It's not going to prevent someone else from making the same mistake. So do we put systems in place to minimize the chance of a mistake being made and for patients to be helped by this treatment? Or is it something like, you know, RSI in San Diego, we're going to throw this out to you, and then when you screw it up, we're going to beat you over the head with it? you know, and no one gets helped, then you have, if there is like a niche patient that might benefit from a treatment that you have available, well, so-and-so got in trouble last week for doing it, so I'm not even going to try it.
Right.
And that's the, sort of the culture we have in place that it comes up a lot on your podcast. I see it a lot in my area. I've seen it in other places I've worked.
Right,
I think
that's what
I
think a little bit that's what I mentioned before too, is like you've got the EMT, they have these tools now in the toolbox, they've had that additional, you know, 2 hours of training, whatever, you know, for whatever procedure it is or whatever medication they can now give, and they get presented with that situation. Like you said, they have minimal training to begin with, minimal patient contacts to begin with in their initial training, and now you're saying, okay, but we want you to really make a life and death decision with medications based on an additional 2 hours worth of training and not a whole hell of a lot of clinical contacts going on, and you have to make this decision. And then you're going to have them, like you said, where they're going to say, well, you know what, I don't really want to do that. I don't have to do it. I can just go ahead and BLS it and wait for the paramedics to get there. I mean, listen, I know EMTs that are uncomfortable sitting in the back with a patient who might be a little hypertensive or who hit their head because they're afraid it's some kind of a bleed going on. But now you're going to turn around and ask that same EMT to make a decision on a patient who's unresponsive because they overdosed, or make a decision on a patient who can't breathe and give them albuterol. I mean, you know, you're asking them to do these things, and a lot of them either aren't comfortable in doing it, a lot of them don't want to do it. You know, I was looking at some of the comments in some of the blogs and Facebook pages on this intranasal issue, and you got people saying, oh, it's a bad idea, no way. But then you get the EMTs who, oh, it's great, I love it, I can't wait. You know, some of them just can't wait to do it. And I'm like, you want to give out medications, you want to do that, go to medic school. Don't sit around waiting for these little bitty additions to your you know, expanding the role that you have, you know, to come along and kind of spoon feed you a little bit here and there to increase your, you know, your responsibilities, increase what you can do on the scene. You know, you want to give medications. You think it's something cool to do and it's something that you want to do, be more, you know, useful to the patients that you're encountering. Then go to med school. You know,
and
don't,
you know what? I definitely understand your frustration with that. And I don't think that I think that as long as we have this sort of ambiguous dividing line, and it's not ambiguous to us because we've gone through the training, we know what we're capable of, but to the general public and to the people who are measuring our effectiveness by response time to the hospital, I mean, you know, time to the hospital, you know, you're going to get that sort of that argument of, well, you know, really, what can an EMT do? What can a medic do? And there's, you know, you're not going to be getting really that decisiveness that says, well, you know, there is a line between a paramedic and EMT. So now when you're in the field and it's an EMT and you're given that responsibility, I understand what you're at, because people can go and do that. EMTs get that in the field, get the responsibility, get the rights to do something, or get the training and the tools to do something, and they don't do it. You show up on scene and say, well, why didn't you do it?
Yeah,
and
a lot of times the response
why
I get, oh, you're just going
that?
To. I get a lot of times I'll get the, oh, we were just going to do that. Oh, I was just getting ready to put the nebulizer together. I was just, me and one of the patients sitting there, they've been on scene for 15, 20 minutes. You know, but part of it, like I said, it can't blame them for not being comfortable with it, though. That's the thing. It's like, you know, it's aggravating they have it, they're not using it, but at the same time, you're asking them to do this additional thing that they're not really comfortable with, because they realize probably, and they know that they don't have that training. They don't have enough training. They don't have enough patient contact, like Bob had said. You know, they might not have as many patient contacts with those types of patients that your average paramedic might have.
100%. And, you know, sort of a homage to Bob here is that what I was originally getting at in the beginning with the BBM and using the Narcan and all of that was that it's just something else to delay their on-scene time when they should be rolling. And, you know, it can help. It may be, you know, while they're in route, help that situation of shortening the amount of time required on the for the BVM, but likelihood is it's not going to.
You know, I disagree with that, Josh, because I think that we look at how long it takes us to get to the hospital. I'll use one example. Like, I was at the hospital, and a patient came in with a BLS ambulance who was actively seizing. And the EMT, it was short ETA, they threw him on the stretcher, gave him oxygen, and drove lights and sirens to the hospital, which was, in that situation, that was the best thing that he could have done. And there's a whole team of people at the hospital that meeting, you know, they go into crisis mode, they go to a room right away, they, you know, a nurse gets an IV, and they give them Ativan, and the seizure stops. Mm-hmm. Now, if an ambulance had arrived there and taken with, whether it's an auto-injector for Versed that's out there now, or if a paramedic has a drug that's available that can stop a seizure, paramedic shows up, gives them seizure medication, however, IV, IM, IN, whatever. Seizure stops. Now we have a slow ride to the hospital. Patient goes into a room, monitored, report goes to a nurse. The physician doesn't need to come in right away.
Yeah, it's
and
more controlled.
There's a whole bunch of things, yeah. And so whoever shows up, whether it's a paramedic or an EMT or whoever shows up, that patient needs to have their seizure stopped. And it's silly that we have, with all the equipment we have available, that patients who don't get that treatment that's available from their EMS system.
So, disagreeing with me?
Because
I'm not,
with Narcan, you know, we have a tool that can, patient airway and respiratory compromise. There's a tool available that can fix that. Suppose they're on the second floor and they need to be carried out of the residence, or they vomit, or something happens, and there is a tool available that can reliably give that patient back their airway reflexes. And yes, there are some risks. I think that that's mostly from misuse and giving too much and too fast. But
and my only objection to that tool was that if it was used in lieu of transportation, like they're going to futz around on scene, give it, wait a few minutes and see if there's a reaction to it. And really where it should be used is in the bus while they're going lights and sirens, and if that person comes around and starts breathing on their own, then they can down triage the job, shut off the lights, and drive more safely to the hospital. And then the patient can get there and be monitored. So,
yeah,
you know,
I disagree. Anytime that we can fix a problem that's going to avoid going lights and sirens to the hospital, I think
that's
worth an extra.
But that's what I'm saying. But the only thing I'm saying.
Josh.
Well, no, I think that, Bob, you're misunderstanding what I'm saying. I'm afraid that it will delay or extend for an EMT having this drug on scene time instead of getting the patient, bagging them, and as they would normally go, they bag them and get them to the hospital expedited. And in this case, they're going to give them Narcan on the scene and wait for a reaction. If there's no reaction, then they're still in the same situation before, but they've been bagging the patient longer, and now they have an extended time to get to the hospital. And the only
and on that note, I'm getting a call, so I'm going to have to check out, guys. But thanks,
Bummer.
All right, Bob.
Yeah. Bob, okay. Have a good night. Thanks.
We should have let him go, and you could have listened to the sirens going while he was going.
Oh man. Well,
Bob,
I think he was misunderstanding what I was saying, but I'd like to know if he was. I mean,
my thing is, Josh, is you know, I know what you're saying as far as you know, them sitting around on scene, but at the same time, if you have an unconscious, unresponsive, you know, overdose, and they don't have the Narcan to give, what are they gonna do? They're gonna be calling for medics, they're gonna be screaming for medics to get there, and they're gonna wait. They're gonna wait for the medics to get there. They're not gonna be, you know, most EMTs are not going to start loading and going because there's only going to be probably two of them there, and they're going to start, you know, hopefully using the BVM and ventilating the patient and assessing what's going on to give the medical report when he gets there. My thing is this, you know, like Bob mentioned, as far as having the tools available when you get on a call to stop a seizure, to do a 12-week, do all this stuff. And this goes back to a podcast we did, you know, a few weeks ago, where my argument was, well, just make everybody a paramedic, okay, since they want to make everything an ALS job anyway, and they want to be able to give and have these resources available to providers to take care of any patient that they encounter, then everybody should be a paramedic and everybody should have these drugs available to them. Not necessarily, you know, sending EMTs, you know, to calls that they're not equipped to handle, or getting there and not being equipped to handle, you know, a certain call.
And really, what's defining their being equipped to handle? Because they have a drug, are they equipped to handle it? You know,
well, that's
and that's really, I think
all you're doing is, and that's what you're doing. Instead of making everybody EMT or making whatever you want to call your the EMS provider, you know, make call them a paramedic or an advanced care professional or whatever you want to call it, you know, making somebody a paramedic, and then on the other hand have an EMT that you're kind of peppering them with selected tools that you think are going to help a selected amount of the population isn't helping the vast majority of patients that we're coming in contact with. We're shortchanging everyone that's calling 911 because you never know what you're going to get when you get there, no matter what the call type is, and you're not really benefiting the patients overall because you're not letting that EMT that arrive have the right tools to take care of any patient they come in contact with. Josh, I have somebody just called in. Let me see who this is. Maybe get another point of view since Bob isn't around. Hey, who's on the line with us? Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hey, I can barely hear you. Who's this?
Oh, my name's Malik.
How's it going? You listen to the show at all? You have any opinion with what we're talking about?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. You know, I mean, I agree that ENT should be given the authority to do more because a lot of times our hands are tied on emergency calls. I mean, we're pretty much, you know, it's not really an ALS call, but it needs some, I don't know what word to use for it. It needs some part of an ALS as far as nitro or albuterol, because a lot of times we get on a call, you don't even know it's an ALS call. You get called as BLS, and it ends up being somebody needing a breathing treatment, and we can't give it to them. We have to now call on someone else to come who's higher level of training than us to provide that simple test. Some of us take albuterol on our own as our own personal medicine.
Right, and we mentioned that, talked about that before, that's a big thing for a lot of patients. They already take drugs like that on their own. But at what point, though, Malik, you know, we're giving these patients, we're giving EMTs this responsibility, but we're not really training them enough.
Paramedic, don't get me wrong, I love my medics, but, I mean, they're downplaying us EMTs. You know what I mean? Before you became a paramedic, you was an EMT. And before there was paramedics, it was nothing but EMTs doing it. You know what I mean?
The answer, though, is to give selected medications, you know, authorization to EMTs to give just selected meds to people based on call types. You know, because then the patient
you
know, like you said yourself, you never know what you're going to come in contact with. So
wouldn't
it be better off just to send medics to everything?
Well, that's in another discussion. I'm sorry.
Malik, I'm going to mute you, Malik, because you got a lot of background noise that I can't hear.
Malik,
can
you have a lot of background
noise. Wait, hold on. Can you get a second, please? Hold on one second.
Okay, Josh.
So, I understand what, you
I just
know,
muted him for a sec.
Yeah, okay. There's obviously there's two sides to this. One is what you're saying, and you and I have had this discussion. That's definitely a way to go. Let's just eliminate, you know, the job differential, and everybody is to the highest level of training. The obvious problem with everybody at the highest level of training is many communities can't afford it. And when we turn around in EMS, it all comes down to money, right? So that is definitely a mitigating factor. But what I wanted to ask Malik is, you know, when you're an EMT and you do an intervention that you've been given to do and it goes wrong, what do you do then? And that's sort of the problem. You don't have the training that's required for this intervention. So, yeah, right. You can give albuterol, but, you know, yeah, have you ever heard
the contraindications of doing things.
Well, have you also heard that not all that wheezes is asthma? Have you ever heard that saying? Not everything that wheezes is asthma?
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, what would you do if you listened to the patient's chest, they were having problems breathing, and you heard wheezing, you heard active wheezing going on, and gave them albuterol, and all of a sudden they're GE. You know, there's you know, could you handle that? Do you know what, you know, what you did? Do you understand why that just going by the contraindication might not be enough? Sometimes there's that gut that says, you know what, this person sort of falls on the grain, you know, falls just inside those contraindications, but I don't think that they're going to get albuterol right now because their wheezing isn't that bad or their stats are better or I know what their stats are. You know, I don't
right.
think, you know, EMTs carry pulse ox. So there's another bit of information. So I think that, unfortunately, you're given the tools, but not all of the stuff.
Not all the tools. That's the issue.
Well, let me rephrase it. In the sense, well, just like they had before, it was just EMT, and then for defibrillation, you had to get certified for that. You can get certified also for these other things. You know what I'm saying? To extend your level of training higher than just an EMT basic.
But now you're a medic.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But, I mean, not fully a medic, but you're an AEMT. You know what I mean? In the sense of you can do a little more, but not quite as much. You know what I mean? Because, like he said, some places can't afford paramedics. But if you can give the skills to your EMTs, which is a little more advanced than just a basic one straight out of boot camp, that's an advantage.
Right.
So,
Malik, thanks.
Yes.
Thanks for your comments, Malik. I have one other call I want to get in before we end the show.
All
but thanks for calling in, bro. Thank you.
Oh, okay, thanks. All right. Bye.
Thank you.
Hey, who's on the line? You still there with us? Hello?
Hello?
No, they hung up.
Oh,
bummer. That's not nice. Now I hung up on Malik, and I was trying to get to the other call, and they hung up.
You can't put them on hold and then switch over.
I know, I can't.
We got to get you.
Well, listen, I'm going to say this. Listen, I know what Malik is saying. You get stuck on the scene. You can't do anything. You kind of get surprised with stuff, and he talks about how
100% right with that too.
Well, he talks about how I used to have to, you know, the defibrillation, you had to go to take another certification. But then where does it end? Is it going to be EMTN for nitro and EMT, you know, IN for intranasal or EMT, you know what I'm saying? It's like at what point does that additional certifications end? Like you said, at that point, you're a paramedic. You know, go be a paramedic. I mean, listen, I know everybody wants to do the best for what the patient needs, you know, but unfortunately, you know, we get dispatched to calls. We don't know what we're going to find when we get there. And like you mentioned, Josh, when you get there, you might have some tools, but you're not going to have all the tools. And then now you've got an EMT who's trying to take on this additional responsibility that they're not sufficiently trained in, that they might not have as much clinical experience in. And in addition to that, you know, think about the fairness to the EMTs. You're asking them to take on this expanded role, okay? And we talked a little bit about, you know, the topic tonight, you know, as far as what's at stake, by doing that. But what about the EMT, the individual EMT that's not getting any more money for taking on this responsibility or for the additional training? You know, they're not getting a salary increase for any of this, but yet they're asked to take on this additional responsibility that the medic who's making all that extra money is supposed to be getting paid for and supposed to be doing because they have that additional training. That's why the medics are getting paid
and
more.
And you know what you should couple with responsibility whenever you're saying it, like additional responsibility is risk. Because they're not only taking
right.
on additional responsibility, they're taking on additional risk. At what point is your livelihood paid off and worth it for the additional risk? You know, that's why in some respects, you know, I've heard the rationalization that paramedics get paid more. They have more responsibility, more risk to their job if they misdirect that responsibility.
Right.
So, you know, you have an EMT. Is that fair to put on somebody who has 200 hours of training or the additional training 250 hours? Or 300, whatever it is. You know, it's not 2,000
right.
hours of training. It's not
and
clinical
again,
time.
And again, I mean, like Bob had mentioned too, you know, a lot of these EMT classes, they don't have a lot of ride-along time. They don't have a lot of clinical time in different parts of the hospital and being exposed to different disease types and patient assessments and all that type of stuff. And then, you know, I mean, even a paramedic coming out of school encountering some of the things we're talking about is going to be can be a little confused or can be overwhelmed by the event. You know what I mean? And
well,
they've already
kind of
been exposed to it.
And my theory behind that lack of training in that case is, you know, very simple. It's because there's a basic disrespect for the capabilities of EMTs. And I think that comes from the medical community because they look and they say, ah, you know, they don't have that much training. Really, what can they do? Their drug of choice is diesel. Okay? And then you turn around and that, of course, flows to the immediate next step, which is paramedics. So, you know, that sort of level of disrespect. So, you know, there's a lot of validity to your idea of saying, you know, let's just eliminate that, get everybody to the medic level, and that's what we should roll with. You know, you don't have, you know, you have nursing as a basic level, and then you have advancement on that degree. You don't have, you know, like a lower level of nurse. That's called
right.
something different, but it's still a nurse. The bottom line,
right.
the bottom thing that you are is a nurse. Then you can expand
right.
your role from there. Why not a medic?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I know that communities don't have all this money to pay paramedic, to have a paramedic agency, okay? But you know what? I think they'd probably find the money if they had somebody die in the community and they found out, what, you didn't have a paramedic to take care of that chest pain? Well,
and that's always what
it is. I'll sue the entire... you know, that entire county, because they didn't provide proper emergency services to my husband or whatnot when he was having chest pain, and he died because you didn't have a paramedic there to take care of him. Then all of a sudden, I'm pretty sure they're going to want to find money to make sure they have paramedic staff in the area to respond to paramedic calls, and not rely on EMTs and volunteers to take care of things, because you know now it comes back to what we mentioned, which is money. It comes back to money, but this time they're paying money out due to a lawsuit rather than due because of what the community actually needs, you know, which it should be. Every patient, when they call 911, should be afforded the highest care they can possibly get, and that is paramedic level care. You know,
right.
it doesn't pay for an EMT to respond for a chest pain call if they can't do anything, or they're not trained to do everything, or they're not ready to do everything that they need to be doing. You know, they might have some tool and they can assist the patient with something, but they don't have all the tools, and that's shortchanging the patient. So, listen, Josh, let's just end it there. We've only got about a minute left. So, of course, thanks, Bob, for calling in. Everyone out there, Bob's not here. He had to go on a call, but you can find Bob at emspatientperspective.com. Josh, you're at wantanew.com. And, of course, you can listen to the archives of this show at EMS Office Hours.
And we only
Josh,
use
thanks.
Real EMS on this show.
Exactly, exactly. Well, Josh, thanks for joining me as usual. I appreciate it. And I guess we're not next week because it's Easter, but we'll see you the week after.
Yeah, have a good one, Jim.
All right, have a great night. Well, everyone, that's it for tonight's show. Thank you again for joining me. Of course, if you have any ideas for a show here at EMS Welfare Hour, send them on over to me. It's Jay Hoffman at EMS-safety.com. I'd love to go ahead and talk about a topic that you're passionate about in EMS and get some thought processes going on anything you want to talk about in the industry. So hopefully send on over to me, and be sure to visit EMSOfficeHours.com and comment in the blog there on past episodes as well. So as always, guys, Jim Hoffman, stay safe.